Hello and welcome to Earth Heart Network Radio, the land-to-mouth food, farm, and garden connection that we make every week live at 1 p.m. here on Tuesdays. So glad to be with you, Lisa Almaraz, your host, and a cloudy fall day. Yes, we've had some fairly hard freezes and things are shifting over. The leaves are down and flowers are frozen and pretty much disappeared in a lot of places, but we still have a few little bright spots of leaves as they continue to fall all the way as the mountains. Elevations do vary, and sometimes you have patches of leaves in color longer than other areas depending on the elevation and conditions, but a beautiful time of year heading toward Thanksgiving and, of course, the holiday season. Much to look forward to, and, of course, lots of great food to be gathering. Some of the last farmers markets are winding up for the year. See where yours are. See about sourcing some of your Thanksgiving, if not all of it, from your local farmers. Do what you can, and, of course, choose organically. That is the key to enjoying the health benefits of our delicious and nutritious food, is keeping it organic and clean. Well, I greet you this week. Hope you're doing well, and invite you to participate here in cutting-edge news information, really looking at how we can do things differently, how we can build sustainable culture, how we can restore our land with restorative agricultural methods, sustainable models, and again, always innovating with organic methods, not only choosing to eat that kind of food, but growing it, spreading the knowledge of how to grow it, and tons of great videos on livingwebfarms.org, just exactly showing you how to do that. Search by topic, learn everything you would like to learn about, and start more community gardens. Help your neighbors start your own garden and share the bounty. It's quite amazing, the model of abundance that nature provides. And so when we are out there planting and sharing, there's always plenty to go around. And restoring nature certainly restores ourselves. It restores our communities, and our health, our connection to the earth is very critical. It's actually correlates directly to our own mental health and our own emotional well-being. And that sense of connecting in nature has so many powerful effects on us when we go out for those wonderful hikes, when we get out by the rivers and the streams, or just listen to the birds or the owls, observing things, even on a fine level, the little local bees and all of the pollinators. Of course, now they're zooming away and just coming out here and there, but really enjoying nature restores us, and restoring nature can restore more of the sanity in our world. And it's been proven many different ways. And right now, we're getting even more data about why restoring nature really is the key to fighting the climate change, and how we're looking at restabilizing our ecosystems. For decades, scientists and policymakers have focused on changing human behavior to address our changing climate and all the pollution and things we're doing, looking at that aspect of it. But, you know, when you really get into it, the regulations have mandated reduced carbon emissions, subsidies have supported the development of renewable energy, and individuals have worked to make their lifestyles more sustainable. But at the same time, we're out there with companies, you know, chopping down forests and destroying the ecosystems out there. So addressing the human aspect, not only of our behavior in cities, but the behavior of destroying nature wholesale, that is truly devastating, and our behavior has to change on that level. A growing body of research is supporting the need for the solutions rooted in nature, ensuring biodiversity, revitalizing the forest ecosystems, and supporting our natural environments is key to our quality of life on Earth. A new study in the journal Nature offers the strongest evidence yet that biodiversity strengthens ecosystems. And we're learning more and more about this. We do talk about it often here on Earth Heart Network Radio. We help ecosystems increase their resistance to extreme climate events and improve their capacity to help stabilize climate. And, you know, a biodiverse environment can truly go through a lot more and be much more resilient than one that is denuded or been destroyed in part or completely, and is trying to heal and revitalize itself. So supporting nature supports us. Great new research happening all over the place. Of course, I shared with you the wonderful news about the monarch butterfly, new speed limit zone happening all over Mexico. There are a host of efforts going on to help the monarchs all over the world. Several countries have been working together, and, you know, I've certainly told you enough times, if you've been listening to the show over a period of months or years, that just in the last year we've had extremely devastating losses to the Monarchs and in recent years, and it's just been really just tragic. And there's all of this habitat that's been destroyed and replaced with herbicide-laden, you know, poisoned crops that don't, first of all, it starves them out. They don't have their milkweed that they need. And then on top of it, the only thing they do find is covered in poison, and they end up dead and decimated. Well, there are a lot of folks getting together to help the Monarchs and other pollinators. Of course, it's a key to our food supply, and goodness knows, butterflies are beautiful. I love them, and I especially love monarchs. I've always loved them, and I'm so happy to hear, and I'd love to report some of this happy news, since we have talked a lot about the sad part of the decimation of their populations. Right now, this just in a couple of days ago from Carola Soleil there at discovery.com, reporting that monarch butterfly populations may quadruple in Mexico due to the great efforts that are happening. Now, we've already had over a 90% loss of them. Okay, so if you lose 9 out of 10 of something and then you quadruple it 4 times more, that's still less than half of what they ought to be. But it's great progress. It's great progress, and I really am happy to hear this wonderful news. The monarch butterflies wintering in Mexico could nearly quadruple in number this year, thanks to actions taken by efforts in the United States, Mexico, and Canada to protect the migratory species. This was just out last Thursday. After years of sharp decline, totally unsustainable levels of decline, the three countries agreed at a summit in February 2014 to form working groups to foster the insect survival. And they have done a lot. Along with all of the small efforts, there's big picture efforts. More than a year later, the measures are having an effect. Mexican Environment Minister Rafael Pachiano said at a news conference at the Piedra Herrada Monarch Reserve alongside U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell. He said authorities hope the orange and black butterfly will occupy between 3 and 4 hectares, that's 7.4 and 9.9 acres of the mountain forest located in central Mexico this season. That's still significantly lower than it had been at one point and as it should be, but it is bigger than it was recently when they were more devastated than they even are now. So there is a little bit of a comeback going on. We've got about 4 times the population that arrived last season there before a tour of the mountaintop where hundreds of butterflies were resting or flying around fir trees. The insect occupied just 1.13 hectares of forest in the past season, better than 2013-14 when the population hit an all-time low of just about 0.67 hectares, only being there in their migratory cluster. But now we're looking at 7.4 to 9.9 acres, actually between 3 and 4 hectares, so we're looking at that number has increased, but of course, we want to see it get even bigger. We want to get it up to 6 hectares by 2020, and that compares to a high where there were so many monarchs at one point in 1996 and 97 that nearly 19 hectares were occupied by the thousands and thousands of the beautiful, breathtaking butterflies. So, you know, they've been on the verge of collapse. Our efforts are doing great things to help them. Of course, it was our blind efforts that decimated them in the first place by having so many pesticides out there and decimating their habitat. But this important operation is working together with also combating illegal logging, and they're working on replanting milkweed in 3 million hectares of land and designating pesticide-free areas. That's what we need. We need these wildlife corridors, right, where the members, the biodiverse community of animals and plants and, well, seeds migrate as well, right? Plants don't really get to migrate unless they're caught on something or an animal brings the seeds, most likely. But, you know, we have animals that move around and need to be able to access different parts of their native ecosystems rather than having them always bisected by huge freeways, interstates. You know, you see so much wildlife out there, roadkill. It's just devastating. And, you know, having more wildlife corridors, pesticide-free zones where we can make room for nature. And gosh, just imagine if we had pesticide-free areas for humans too, right? We often see that going on right next to schools, right next to communities. You can just measure the amount of this stuff that's going out there. And we've just got to stop poisoning ourselves, right? And nature. But so great to see the monarchs making a bit of a comeback thanks to the help of humans who were the problem to begin with for them. So we got to take responsibility for helping out. And we can also help out with the orangutan. Right now, we've got a last stand going on in Indonesia. We've got the rainforest on fire over there, land being cleared, and the most majestic, beautiful people of the forest there, the orangutan, are dying. They are suffering. They are being burned alive. I mean, they're cutting and chopping and burning their whole home down, their whole forest. And, you know, when someone's house catches on fire, their home catches on fire, they can leave the house, right? But in a jungle, when you're an orangutan, you live in the jungle. You can't just go away and live in a city and get an apartment. You know, it's a really different situation for them. And so we've got to preserve and protect them as well, honoring their place on Earth and our relationship with them, their relationship to the Earth. Right now, it's being called the last stand of the orangutan. Rainforests are being destroyed by man-made fires for palm oil, and pushing the last wild orangutans to the brink of extinction. Palm oil is found in roughly half the products sold in grocery stores and is a major cause of rainforest destruction and human rights abuses. You know, you can jump in and let your voice be heard on this. I encourage you to do so. Go to RAN.org. That is a Rainforest Action Network. RAN.org. Last stand of the orangutan. There's a petition there. And you can add your voice to demand the world's biggest snack food companies, such as PepsiCo, eliminate conflict palm oil from their supply chains. Get rid of this product that is basically contains ingredients that cause massive crimes against nature, against these beautiful creatures. And, you know, we can do things sustainably, more intelligently, and with respect for others, including orangutans in the forest and all of the millions of creatures that live there. So add your voice. I'm going to do that right now and give those little orangutans a little voice, because, you know, they can't do this. They can't sign these petitions. They're just running from the loggers and the fires and the scary stuff with their little babies. And there's a really cute little picture of a mama orangutan with her little baby right here on that petition as well. So I encourage you, let your voice be heard, RAN.org. And you can even contribute if you'd like to help them out. They need the help. And we need to stop mining our forests and just destroying them for short-term gain, long-term loss. And just how long can we do that? Well, we're kind of running out of the beautiful places out there. So it's time to stop, turn it around, turn the whole thing around in the right direction, and change the way we've been doing things. The way we've been doing things the last 100 years or so is quite a new little blip on the map. And yet we've caused more destruction than we had in the last thousands and thousands of years before that. What is up with this unsustainable development, right? Aren't we supposed to be quite intelligent beings? You know, creatures and communities that can work together and actually create systems that work for everyone, that work for the planet and for us without poisoning us. I think it's doable. I mean, it's not only doable, I mean, it's imperative, right? We've got to retool industry to be sustainable rather than ecocidal, to support life, to build life rather than to destroy it. I know we can do it. I found out about so many fantastic innovations in my life. I know so many brilliant people that are doing wonderful things out there, that have invented great products, that are contributing to society in powerful, wonderful ways. There is so much going on for the good that we can be integrating into our society, and yet there are so many folks out there that are in these businesses that just because it's about making an idea of money, that they're willing to just destroy the earth. You know, that's pretty lopsided priorities, in my opinion. So, you know, let's build the models that work, the clean, green, sustainable energy models, the sustainable agricultural models based on organic, innovative principles of growing food and building soil, building nutrition, building our health. Our ability to function together is enhanced by all of that. It all works together when we're doing it in a peaceful way that honors life. And when we're doing the opposite, well, what do? We destroy nature. And sometimes we've just been sitting along doing it for such a while now, even though it's a tiny blink in the real expanse of time. When you look at the big picture, it really has seemed like a long time. I mean, you know, my whole lifetime, I watch the pollution. I watch, you know, the increase of destruction of the rainforests. I watch all of these things going extinct, and you see all of these millions of acres being sprayed with poisons and all of these pollinators dying. And, you know, I experience all this. It's kind of, you know, agony in a way to be witnessing it. But yet, sometimes we have these wake-up calls where we find out, oh, that's how it's been affecting things. And then next thing you know, We have a chance. We have a chance to do it differently. Now, we've always had a chance, but every once in a while you get a really bright spotlight somewhere that just exemplifies what we need to do to change. And in this case, I'd like to cite the lawsuit that the city of Oakland, California, has filed against Monsanto. Yes, they're suing, as well as Los Angeles County. They're suing as well for a different environmental disaster that's been going on there. But up in Oakland, in the San Francisco Bay Area, Oakland is suing Monsanto for longstanding contamination of San Francisco Bay. San Francisco Bay. Yes, agrochemical giant Monsanto knowingly contaminated Oakland's stormwater and the San Francisco Bay with a highly toxic chemical for decades. A new lawsuit filed by the California city claims Oakland wants the company to pay for the environmental cleanup. The State Water Resources Control Board determined that the presence of highly toxic polychlorinated biphenyl, yes, PCBs, they were found in Oakland stormwater, and it threatens the San Francisco Bay's ecosystem as well as interferes with the bay's use and enjoyment by Californians, the city said in a statement. PCBs were widely used for five decades to insulate electronics and were incorporated into paints, caulks, and other building materials until they were banned by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in 1979. Despite the 36-year prohibition, the chemicals are a common environmental contaminant in water, and they're also found in the tissues of marine life all the way up the food chain right to the humans. So, basically, they're saying Monsanto knew that PCBs were toxic and could not be contained as they readily escape into the environment, finding their way into bays, oceans, lakes, rivers, streams, soil, air, humans. Although evidence confirms that Monsanto recognized that PCBs were becoming a global contaminant well before the 1979 ban, it concealed this information and increased production of these profitable compounds. Once again, short-term profit, long-term loss, the loss being far greater than any illusion of profit. Oakland and Alameda County could be forced to spend $1 billion to remove the PCBs from the stormwater flowing into San Francisco Bay. The city said the lawsuit is asking Monsanto bear the cost of cleaning up the contamination. They knew the products posed a threat to human and environmental health, but they just produced more and more of them. Other California cities such as San Jose, San Diego have filed similar lawsuits against Monsanto, as has Spokane, Washington. It would not be unprecedented for Oakland to win. In May 2012, Swiss agrochemical group Syngenta was forced to pay $105 million to settle a class action case, and that was regarding poisoning hundreds of community drinking water systems with atrazine, a weed killer. We've got more and more of these cases. It's been a ton of lawsuits regarding this. Montana was forced to pay $2.4 million settling another lawsuit with wheat farmers in November of 2014 after its genetically engineered strain of Roundup Ready was supposedly outlawed and scrapped a decade ago. It was found alive and well in Oregon, and they have had settled lots of other class action lawsuits. And I really don't like all these settlements because then there's no liability admitted. They just keep doing it, and they just keep paying off these settlements, and there's not an improvement going on in the mass scale that should be going on. And, you know, we've got all these poisons out there, and they go straight up the food chain, right into our food, right on our plate, right into our organs, and they accumulate, and they cause diseases. And then those studies are suppressed because there's a lot of pressure out there to keep pumping out these poisons. But thankfully, around the world, they're waking up. The bans across the EU are happening for genetically modified organisms. There's more and more organic farmers starting up farms all over the world. It's fantastic news. The market demand for organic food and sustainably produced food is higher than ever. The market demand for organic and sustainably produced food is expected to grow faster than any other segment of the market. Hundreds and hundreds of McDonald's are closing all over the world. I just saw one today. I drove by the former location of McDonald's in Black Mountain, North Carolina, and I saw that it was closed. Yes. Now, there was some other fast food places just chugging along next to that. But yes, we are shifting our choices. We're being healthier. We're creating the market demand for more organic by choosing that. We're enjoying better quality of life. We're feeling better by eating like that. And planting gardens heals the soul, and it feels great, and we get to share. We get to share the food. Isn't it wonderful? and it's time to celebrate, right? It's celebration time, Thanksgiving. We give thanks for a wonderful year. We give thanks for the many, many advances we've made as we take steps in the right direction, helping creatures like the monarchs to make a sort of comeback and to keep making those comebacks and to take back the millions of acres that are currently being contaminated with these toxins, to go ahead and build that life back in the soil, to remediate our biology, to get the water clean again, to get the air clean again, to have beautiful sunsets again. It's all possible. And every single step in the right direction counts. And that's what is heartening. And that's what I, you know, invite you to celebrate every day as you take those little steps. That's what builds the big picture. The big climb up the mountain is a lot of little steps. And I'd like to acknowledge one of the little steps. This happened in Mexican courts. Yes, Monsanto was handed a double whammy there recently over planting GMOs. This just out about 8 days ago, opponents of genetically modified organisms in Mexico have claimed victory after the Mexican Supreme Court blocked last week a move that would allow the cultivation of GMO soy in the Mexican state of Campeche and Yucatan. In a separate appeals court decision, a federal judge upheld a 2013 ruling that barred companies such as Monsanto and DuPont, Pioneer, from planting or selling their GMO corn within the country's borders. Mexico is the cradle of corn. Many, many heirloom varieties that are born there from thousands of years of cultivation with the native peoples of the Americas. Beautiful, absolutely wonderful corn. I love my corn tortillas. I love corn masa. I love corn chips. And you know, it's a sacred thing. This plant is sacred to the people of Mexico. And here comes Monsanto with these GMO things after a tradition of thousands of years of handing down heirloom seed varieties in families and in generations of farmers and gardeners, that they come in and you know, are going to potentially contaminate their heirloom varieties, as well as, oh, now you have to buy our seed, which who wants that stuff anyway, right? And so they've had quite a battle there with corn in Mexico. Here in America, we've got tons of GMO corn blowing around all over the place and all those pollens and things and contaminating other organic farms in a big way. But we've got some progress happening in Mexico. Yes, this was breaking news last week. Monsanto has lost twice there. In one federal ruling, Federal Court of Appeals upholds the ban on planting of GMO corn in Mexico. And then now they're blocking the planting of GMO soy in two of the states there. So great to see this double whammy in a good way for heirloom corn, for the cradle of corn of Mexico. And it's great to see, according to a report from Mexico News Daily, the ruling last Wednesday favored an injunction filed by Maya beekeepers on the Yucatan Peninsula, where honey production and collection is its main industry. And lots of environmental organizations such as Greenpeace, Indignación, and Litiga OLE reportedly said that GMO soybeans in the region would put honey production and about 15,000 Maya farm families at risk due to the use of the herbicide glyphosate, which has been linked to cancer. It also claimed that soy production would lead to deforestation in Campeche. And, of course, there's Campeche Bay. The Bay of Campeche is right there, and that's, of course, a lot of other wildlife and animals that live there along that Gulf Coast of Mexico. Monsanto has since given a response to the decision, denying that their GMO soy has impacted bees, caused deforestation, or damaging honey industry. They don't accept their part in that. But as for GMO corn, Sustainable Pulse reported that federal judge Benjamin Soto Sanchez, head of the Second Unitarian Court in Civil and Administrative Matters of the First Circuit, upheld a provisional suspension prohibiting pertinent federal agencies from processing and granting the privilege of sowing or releasing into the environment of transgenic maize in the country. So this decision came despite 100 challenges by transnational agribusiness interests and the federal government, according to Sustainable Pulse. And thank you, EcoWatch.com, for carrying this story. So yes, even though there was 100 different challenges by these huge organizations and agribusiness models that are out there promoting all these poisons, they still stood for their corn. And you know, that's what it takes sometimes. It's just standing your ground for what's right and just staying true, not necessarily because of what everyone's doing, but in spite of what others are doing, doing what's right, doing the best thing. This staunch anti-GMO movement has swelled in the country in order to preserve their unique biodiversity of their staple crop, corn. And it's so significant to them that they take it as, you know, their whole country has great biological, cultural, agricultural diversity. And so they really are considering this as a farming nation. And it's really wonderful to see that. And they were adding and talking about it. The lead plaintiff's organization, Demanda Colectiva, who talked about the significance of these cases, said, in a country like ours, among other negative effects that would result is that Mexican honey would be difficult to keep organic. And it's the same with the corn. You can't keep the organic crops safe when you've got the contamination of GMOs going on. So great to see progress there in Mexico regarding, you know, banning this stuff and not being allowed to cultivate it there. And we've got to be able to move these changes into America. Right now we've got fantastic changes happening all over the world, banning of more GMOs everywhere. And yet in America, we're rolling out more and more and more of them and more poisons to go with them. And meanwhile, we're trying to help the pollinators and the monarchs. We can't really do both effectively, right? We've got to stop doing the poison part, and then we can truly be helping all of the systems and pollinators that rely on those ecosystems they feed on, like the butterflies and the milkweed. Earth Heart Network Radio, the Land to Mouth Food Farm and Garden Edition. We come this way every Thursday and talk to you Tuesday. My brain just skipped 2 days there. Every Tuesday at 1 p.m. and hopefully we'll be joined by Patrick Battle soon. He missed us last week. He was caught in transit, but he will be sharing this week in the garden shortly. You can always get questions to Pat if you'd like to address your own gardening questions. You can email those to pat@livingwebfarms.org. Well, looking at sustainability, we've got some tools that we can start using. Sometimes we use our tools like our chainsaws and our different kinds of machines. We use them kind of destructively. Well, finally, we've got some indigenous peoples that have been given interactive maps to help secure their land rights. You know, in a lot of places around the world, as we've covered here on the show, many, many, many native people do not even know where the true boundaries of their lands are because they live in these jungles. They live in places where maybe a certain part of the stream marked a boundary or some natural landmark of a tree or something like that. And they don't have well demarcated zones. And, you know, it's certainly, we don't want to be circumscribing native people to the point where we eliminate their ability to live naturally. But in some places, they really need to be able to see where the land starts and finishes and where the property rights are, because these logging companies are coming in, all kinds of mining companies, all these things are happening, and they need tools to figure out where their lands are and how they can help manage them and protect them. And the indigenous people, whose land rights have often been exploited due to lack of maps and data, they now have a new tool to help secure their rights, a global interactive map of the land they claim called Landmark. So it's a digital model, landmarking software, and it's going to be providing indigenous people and communities the opportunity to be proactive in their efforts to protect their lands, not just reactive to the imminent threats. So it will help them establish legal rights. And, you know, when we preserve and protect the native people's rights to live in their natural environment, in the forests, and protect those forests, we're protecting the ecosystem and the biodiversity and the community that lives there of all the different creatures that live in harmony. So these tools in the hands of the indigenous people are wonderful. And basically, the indigenous people and communities claim to hold about 2/3 of the world's land, but are legally recognized as only holding about 10%. This is according to think tank World Resources Institute, one of the organizations behind the project. By visualizing the locations of indigenous peoples and local communities involving perhaps 2 billion people, Landmark pushes their existence into the calculations of those making decisions about climate change, economic development, poverty alleviation, and natural resources conversation. And that's from Peter Veit, the director of the WRI's Land and Resources Rights Initiative. He said that in a statement. And, you know, even though we might not live in that forest and we might not be part of an indigenous community, I mean, I think we all have roots to those places. Those people that still live there, that's a very, very sacred and precious place that they hold for all of us. That deep connection of living in nature and in balance with nature from a lineage of thousands of years. That's a priceless treasure of knowledge. And we should be helping these people sustain their way of life rather than driving them out to take what we can while we destroy their forests. Because those forests are all of our forests. And what do we do if the people aren't there with the lineages that know those forests inside out? That know the stories and the songs from all the plants and all of the ways that the animals live and work together? There's great knowledge in that. And so they need their rights, and they need to be able to respond to things like the palm oil plantations we were talking about earlier, the exploitative development of natural resources, logging, all the reasons their lands are being taken. They've got to be able to map their territories, be able to look at their communities and secure their land rights so they can reduce deforestation and work out the land use conflicts that have been going on for hundreds of years. They can prevent tens of millions of tons of carbon dioxide emissions each year by preserving and protecting these places. And so I really am so happy to hear about the development of this, and thanks to the sustainability desk there at thomsonreuters.com. Fantastic to learn about this wonderful partnership that was developed by a group of indigenous people for land rights and research bodies. The beta version of the map just launched last Tuesday, showing the boundaries of thousands of pieces of land claimed by indigenous people and communities around the world. It offers additional information about the land, such as land category and area. It's still in the developmental stage. The map is not a crowdsourcing platform, but aims to provide only high-quality data from recognized organizations and experts who can submit their entries directly through landmarkmap.org. So landmarkmap.org, check it out. This is the new map for indigenous people to be able to figure things out and be able to protect and preserve their ways of life, because they have been threatened and they're still threatened today because of the treasures that the forests hold. But the forest itself, as a whole collective ecosystem, is the greatest treasure of all. And that's part of creating a foundation of stability in our ecosystems and our global climate and our global quality of life on Earth. So great to hear. And thank you so much to those people there at WRI, World Resources Institute, really getting behind this and bringing this project to life. It's so inspiring, isn't it? So many times Indigenous people have been left out of the conversation, murdered. Genocide, you know, has happened for hundreds of years. It's really pretty rough when you look at what's been done. But yet, there they are with the wisdom and knowledge of these places. And it's up to us to take the time to learn and then to honor, respect, preserve, and protect. Earth Heart Network Radio, the Land to Mouth Food Farm and Garden Edition, exploring cutting-edge news and information. Great to see, as we've been looking at all of the different stories out there, what's going on. Of course, our hearts go out to lots of people that have suffered in the attacks in Paris that happened. Just want to mention that, because what we were talking about regarding Paris was the climate talks. And many are saying that this is sort of to stymie the climate talks and create a whole tense environment around there. Because really what's needed is we need to have a very binding agreement going on for this year's meeting this month in Paris. And now with all this new, you know, head massacre that has gone on around the city, you know, it's kind of put quite an edge on things. But we can't forget how big this conversation is. It's vital. And we've got to have binding agreements. And we can't get distracted by the bloodshed that looks so obviously orchestrated to do that. We've got to stay focused on what's important. And of course, having peace is extremely important. But we just so happen to have this attack right when we're about to have that meeting there in Paris. So we've got to still focus on the meeting and what's important. We've got to, you know, maintain and work on healing the community, but also really look at some binding agreements at this climate talk. I've got to keep our eye on the ball here. It's really important. We have powerful things we can do. Just by covering the soil with cover crops, planting more gardens, we can actually draw down all the carbon necessary to truly make a massive difference. But instead, we're still tilling, and we've got lots of bare ground out there, but let's start covering it up. Let's do the things that we know work. Let's restore nature, and it will restore us. There's some fantastic things going on. We just recently had a law passing industrial hemp here in North Carolina. I was really thrilled to talk to the gentleman that helped bring that effort to life at the Carolina Farm Stewardship Sustainable Agriculture Conference. They still need about $200,000 to form a commission to be able to start to issue the licenses and permits to begin the industrial hemp farming here in North Carolina. Colorado has hemp growing. They've got industrial hemp. We've got Kentucky with legalized industrial hemp. And now in Colorado, thank you to westward.com, Colorado hemp honey is the bee's knees and a healthy CBD option. Yes, the cannabinoid oils that are not the kind that are considered, you know, the drug. The CBD oils from hemp, industrial hemp, can actually offer a healthy option without being associated with the quote-unquote high of the other sort of hemp that's out there, okay? And now Nick French is sharing his dozen beehives he's got on 70 acres of a Colorado hemp farm. With these bees, he has harnessed the power of three superfoods to create his Colorado hemp honey. Yes, it's hemp honey containing whole CBD hemp extract, and it's a very healing compound there. This whole CBD hemp extract, as well as essential oils for a little flavoring and aromatherapy, it's a locally grown line of raw honey, and it packs a powerful healing punch. Yes, Nick French has brought his bees to the hemp farm. He brought them there long before he had visions of honey jars. The goal that he had, and it's quite interesting, you know, sometimes we do something and it just leads us right to something we had no idea that we were going to discover. Just by following our heart and doing something that we know is right, boom, we lead ourselves to something we had no idea we were going to find out about. And this is a classic example of that. He brought his bees to his hemp farm to increase seed production, because the seeds were so expensive that he wanted to grow his own seeds for his industrial hemp. So he wanted to improve seed production, so he brought in the bees. The DEA and the U.S. government regulate all the viable hemp seed that comes into the country. So basically, you cannot import hemp seed until you get approved by the DEA. So farmers there have to save their seeds and plant them again. This drives the seed prices so high that they were over $4,000 a pound last year. Hemp seeds, $4,000 a pound. And they don't want to pay that. So they're like, hey, let's get some bees in here and make a bunch more seed and save a bunch. So many farmers were forced to pay as much as $10 a seed. And, you know, that doesn't really work, right? That's not financially sustainable to do. So then the bees came in, saved the day. Yes, they were hired by Hemp Farm Colorado to come in and put bees on the hemp and increase seed production. Hemp is wind pollinated, but the wind pollination does not guarantee seed production, especially not in the volume that they wanted. So they brought in the bees. They've gotten not only increased seed production, but fantastic hemp extracts, CBDs, and hemp honey now with healing infusions with names like Mandarin Magic and others. Yes, it's looking great. They've got a wonderful, peaceful, symbiotic relationship going between bees and hemp flowers. That isn't new information. It's kind of a famous relationship. Bees have basically dominated the seed production game for about 150 million years. So bees are not only critical to our food supply and pollinating things that become things we eat, but also for the seeds that grow the plants themselves. So the bees were all over the hemp. It was amazing, recalls French, whose bees are distributed throughout the metro area. Within 25 miles of Denver, there are over 40 hives, 40 colonies, and they've got it from Parker to North Denver. So there's about six different apiaries, ranging from backyard beekeeping to 27 acres to small orchards in Greenwood Village. Last year, he had them near Wash Park. So they've got locally sourced beekeeping really paying off, as the superfood effects of raw honey are most powerful when you're ingesting honey made by bees in your own neighborhood. So finding honey produced as close to home as possible is the best for us. And that's what helps us be resistant to the seasonal allergies. And basically it helps you to desensitize your body to the local pollens and getting a little bit adapted to them. A spoonful of honey is like medicine, wonderful healing, adaptogenic medicine for our immune system when we're using our locally sourced raw honey. So great new relationship happening there out in Colorado with the hemp and the seeds and the very healing compounds found in the CBD oil and their hemp honey. This Nick French was a former Marine, and he's been producing honey for 7 years now. Raw honey is a superfood on its own, but he got curious about what would happen if it also contained the healing benefits of the cannabinoid oils, the CBDs there. A few years ago, French was approached by a local advocacy group, and he started learning about the health benefits of industrial hemp. Since CBD is not THC, there are no psychoactive properties involved, nor does the resulting product fall under regulatory rules enforced by the Marijuana Enforcement Division. So it's just a non-drug version there. Colorado's government branch regulates cannabis, but CBD is still touted as helping stomach and anti-inflammatory problems, along with many other maladies, one being seizures. Children with seizure problems have been helped. But they've got an entourage of effective benefits going on with this, and so great to see that doing one thing all of a sudden leads you to something else. And it's just fantastic to see the success. They've got Colorado hemp honey. They say it makes people sleep like a baby. A little goes a long way. They've say put it in some tea, eat it as a honey stick. They've got superfoods that you can make with it. You can do an Adopt-A-Bee program. They sell shares to that. People get a certificate and a jar of honey. They're helping to support honeybees in Colorado and growing their hives and getting more bees out there, getting more seeds produced, getting more CBD oil and more hemp honey. What a wonderful strategy there. Fantastic to see the progress happening. And here's to more industrial hemp happening. More of the health benefits of our plants and all of the different healing plants that are out there. Learning our botany, learning about what is going on in our plant world around us. Maybe what forageable plants are surrounding us. Maybe they're in our yard. Maybe they are available at our community garden or local edible park. Maybe you could just plant something easily, like microgreens over winter, even in a windowsill, or just some fresh herbs to have to pluck as the winter goes by. Always a great joy and celebration to make these connections with nature, with agriculture, and doing it in a whole new way that is healthier and good. Meanwhile, we've got all kinds of other things going on where we need to make improvements. Always room for more improvements. And of course, recently we heard about the Department of Ag being sued for withholding safety information about GMO crops. That's why I say just eat local, eat organic. Don't even buy non-organic food if you can possibly help it. Certainly stay away from microwaving your food. It does mess it up as well. Eat fresh food. The fresher, the better. Right? Don't overcook things. Keep those nutritional values up high. Drink lots of fresh, good, healthy water. Get exercise, right? Meditate, keep your mind clean and clear, and you can really enjoy life at a much higher level. And, you know, we've got all kinds of yummy stews we can be making out there. We've got the cool weather inspiring lots of great soups. And, of course, now a wonderful time to eat root vegetables like, you know, our sweet potatoes and carrots and regular potatoes. I've got some beautiful blue potatoes, making those delicious vegetable and long simmering stews. And of course, Thanksgiving around the corner. And you know, there are some very nice options out there for some new things, new kinds of rolls, nut rolls, and different flavored things that I encourage you to try. I do a very traditional meal, pretty much the same thing every year, but every once in a while on the front end and the back end of Thanksgiving or toward Christmas, I like to try new things, right? So explore new recipes and find new ways to eat organically as you go through this holiday season, and we'll feel better and we'll actually enjoy it more, right? And so it's an adventure, and it's really fun to share food, right? It's really fun to share food in celebration, and that's what we get to do so abundantly here at this time of year. Well, looking at more interesting information going on, and, you know, roots are the key, right? Having our roots, and that's what nature does in wintertime. The trees reach down and grow their roots even deeper and hold on to that soil and hold the earth in place. And I'd like to let you know about a wonderful picture story that has just come out in National Geographic. It came out this last month here in October. It's called Digging Deep Reveals the Intricate World of Roots. And, you know, when we talk about it a lot at Living Web Farms, because we cover crops and getting those exudates out there, you can check out Soil and Diverse Cover Crops, a fantastic video series with Ray Archuleta. He very much shows you how the roots hold on to things and keep those plant communities together, working together, exchanging nutrients. It holds the soil. It holds the earth together. Roots are critical. And so when we have an opportunity to dig deep here, and thanks to Becky Harlan at National Geographic, these intricate root systems are truly astonishing. And when you look at how we produce things and how different that the roots structures are depending on what we're doing, it is amazing. And some of the pictures in this, I would just encourage you to check out. They have done quite an extensive pulling together of root images, root details. I've never seen roots like this. So thanks, National Geographic. Of course, National Geographic was just recently bought out by Rupert Murdoch, and they just are finishing firing their award-winning staff as they replace it with their own staff. So look for a changing face, a changing culture, basically, at National Geographic. It's not going to be the venerable magazine that we've known. It's going to change significantly now. So I'm really grateful for this wonderful, wonderful article that is one of those hallmark quality articles that you find normally all these years in National Geographic. So great to see. And some of the details on this, well, it's just astonishing. You know, our grasses are all over the country. That's just the tip of the iceberg when you look at what holds our heartland together, what holds our soils together. And, you know, we're pretty blind to what's going on beneath the soil. But yet it's time for us to see beneath that surface and to really be aware of how those deep roots connect us and connect us to the earth and actually hold the earth together. Photographer Jim Richardson became well acquainted with the world of dirt while working on Our Good Earth, a 2008 National Geographic magazine story. And that's a different article there that was written a while back, but you can look it up. It's called Our Good Earth. And he got into it and then, you know, started looking even deeper. If you just a prairie grass, as an example, it turns out, you can't even see where the roots are, but they can extend anywhere from 8 to 14 feet of roots going down into the earth. Why should we care? Well, besides being impressively large, intricate, and vital to the life of our soil, these hidden root balls accomplish so much. They store carbon, they nourish the soil, they increase bioproductivity, and prevent erosion. Unfortunately, these productive perennial grasses, which live year-round, are more rare than they once were. We've really been destroying a lot of our native grasses. When you say the American Midwest is a breadbasket, essentially, Richardson says, what you mean is that you've taken out the prairie grasses. You went out with Willa Cather and the plow that broke the plains, plowed up the grassland, and started planting annual grasses like wheat, sorghum, corn, any of the big grains that supply most of our calories. But a challenge in raising the profile of this tall grass ecosystem is that so much of it is underground and therefore difficult to visualize. Well, now we have this epic photography going on. Richardson wanted to reveal these roots to the world, highlighting not only their productive attributes, but also their surprising scale and intricacy. Logistically speaking, he had to get creative, because if you were to try and dig up the roots of switchgrass from any old prairie, well, you would just destroy them in the process. So how did they do this? How did he unearth these extremely large and intricate root systems without destroying them, right? You know how many times you try to pull a plant or a weed up or something, and there goes the whole root, and it just comes right back, right? It's like, oh, man, that thing's down there. Well, he couldn't get them out of the ground, so he'd be going down about 10 feet and try to excavate all around them to get them out, and it just wouldn't work. So he collaborated with Jerry Glover, an agroecologist and a National Geographic emerging explorer, who developed a method of growing tall grasses in root tubes made from PVC pipes while he was working at the Land Institute there in Salina, Kansas. Agroecologist, right? Isn't that interesting? So it takes a year or two to grow the plants. When they're ready, the tube is split, and after a good wash, the roots come out intact and ready for their close-up. So they basically grew these things in containers and let them grow, and then they could get these amazing shots that would never have been possible. So check it out. National Geographic, digging deep, revealing the intricate world of roots. The roots that hold us together, right? And we also use roots metaphorically. The roots that hold us to our ancestors, to our past, to our lineage, to our wonderful things that have been passed down from generation to generation. And now we can see the roots up close of these amazing grasses, the prairie grasses. You know, one prairie grass here is 14 feet long, a tangle of Indian grass, compass plant, and big blue stem that he grew. They welded together two 55-gallon drums, laced the inside with a wire frame, filled the tall container with soil and seed, and then watered and waited. 3 years later, he cut open the barrels and laid a giant bouquet of native prairie plants out, laid those roots bare, and we get to see it. It is amazing. And you know about roots, but you really, to see them like this, like never before, it gives you a true appreciation. Now, after they figured out how to grow these things to get the roots to be exposed without destroying them, then came the second hurdle, how to capture the scale and the texture of these roots at the same time. So, you know, they're huge. They're basically huge. They go 10, 15 feet into the earth. So Glover basically brought the roots over to the gallery, rolled them on the floor, and said, how can we photograph this? So, you know, they had to figure this out. And basically, he describes their solution as being similar to that of a flatbed scanner. They put a long piece of plexiglass on a platform and laid the roots out. Then they put a camera up above the plant on a ladder so they could look straight down, starting at the top. Then they would photograph along and go to each section, working their way down as the camera stayed still. Then they took these photos, about 8 and 14 to 14 per plant, stitched them together into a super high-resolution image, like a vertical panorama. Then they had to find walls high enough for the print job. So this is an entire piecing together of this extravagantly wondrous roots. And so definitely a whole new way to look at prairie grasses and at other plants too. They're all different, but this one focuses on our prairie grasses. NationalGeographic.com. Deep, digging deep, reveals the intricate world of roots. That's the name of it. Earth Heart Network Radio, Lisa Almaraz with you. So glad to talk with you this day. And enjoy our time exploring cutting-edge information, inspiring things to take action on, and then being aware, just being aware of some of the things that are going on out there. Now, air masses migrate, right? And this just came out on Saturday, November 7th, talking about permafrost thawing. Okay, we've got record rates of permafrost thawing, the ice melting up in the Arctic. We've got massive ice melt going on. And we get some surprises sometimes when we have these changing atmospheres happening. We get some surprises. Sometimes things are coming out of the ground that were in there that were frozen over. And now we've got Arctic mercury pollution. Yes, it's going to increase as permafrost thaws. Warming soil will now allow long dormant bacteria to wake up and begin converting inert mercury to its more toxic form. And thanks to Emily Gertz for this story there at Robin Wenstenra Blogspot. Yes, the Barents Observer helped bring this to us. Thawing Arctic permafrost may well unleash a new wave of toxic mercury pollution, says scientists, contributing to ongoing mercury poisoning issues in parts of the region. Mercury poisoning harms wildlife, causes developmental and neurological damage in human fetuses and children. These soils were frozen year-round as recently as just 10 to 20 years ago. Frozen all the time for our known time here, right? They've just been frozen forever. But now they thaw and refreeze annually. This is from lead author Dwayne Elias, a microbiologist with the Oak Ridge National Laboratory's federally owned research center in the United States. As the freeze-thaw cycle continues in coming years, he said, bacteria that contain the genes needed to convert the inorganic mercury to its toxic form called methylmercury will wake up from being dormant for thousands and thousands of years. Groundwater will transport this methylmercury into rivers and streams that game animals such as moose and caribou drink from. Those water flows will also carry the mercury into coastal habitats of marine mammals and fish. Inert mercury is carried by the Arctic, by global wind and water currents from sources in lower latitudes, largely coal-fired power plants and small-scale gold mining. In Asia and Southeast Asia are spewing this stuff out, much of the time without regulation to limit it. There's also been cases of mercury poisoning caused by pollution and illegal waste dumping from industrial operations sited in the Arctic. So we've got more contamination happening because of our destabilization and because of our modification of weather and the climate. We've got to be restoring nature, restoring ecosystems. The restorative model is what will heal us and the planet. And the more we make those organic, healthy choices, the more that we can be working to restore nature and to take back those acres and to start letting those business models that are not healthy, that are damaging both to the planet and to us, just letting them go and watching them go out of business and supporting the clean, green businesses that really help create sustainable culture. So we've got big demands for green things, big demand for organic. The more we choose it, the more we empower that, the more we grow our own food, save our seeds, share them, buy from our local farmers, we benefit and we feel better. And so let your voice be heard on things that you truly care about regarding these issues. I encourage you to take action daily. Even just a small step can do a lot. And you know what? It uplifts our spirit and helps us feel better. And make those healthy choices every single chance you get. We'll talk to you again soon right here on Earth Heart Network Radio next week. So we look forward to being with you then, sharing more awesome information and garden news right here on Earth Heart Network Radio, the Land to Mouth Food, Farm, and Garden Edition.